and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with historians Mark Harrison and Stephen Wheatcroft about the final volume of the History of Soviet Industrialization, entitled The Soviet Economy and the Approach of War, 1937-1939. Stephen, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourselves.
Well, I'm Mark Harrison. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Warwick, working on Russia, on communism. I spent quite a bit of time on the economics of the two world wars and the Cold War. And I currently work on aspects of Soviet security and surveillance. The industrialization of the Soviet economy has been probably my most long-term interest.
Stephen?
Hi. I'm Steve Wheatcroft, currently professor of Soviet history at the University, Deakin University in Melbourne, a long-time professor of, at the University of Melbourne. I'm an economic historian, a long-time with an area of studies interest in the Soviet Union, particular interest, I suppose, in demographic history and in agricultural history, famines, also repression. I was a postgraduate student under Bob Davis, who was the main author of the series, The Industrialization of the Soviet Russia, the seven volumes. I was a postgraduate student under him in the 1970s. And I suppose, consequently, that this series and sort of continuing Bob's work has been a major element in my life since my postgraduate student days.
What you've just mentioned, Stephen, is something of the lineage of this series. I was wondering if the two of you could explain a bit about the series, The Industrialization of Soviet Russia, and how it was the two of you came to be involved in contributing to this volume.
As I mentioned, Bob Davies, Birmingham University, was the originator of the series, and I think it grew fairly organically out of his work with E.H. Carr on the 14-volume history of the Soviet Revolution, 1917-29. Bob collaborated with E.H. Carr, particularly for the economic sections, the foundations of the planned economy. Foundations of the planned economy really began in 1926, going on to 1929. And so Bob then took on the story after the 14 volumes of the E.H. Carr into a near seven volumes of Soviet industrialization, 1929 through to 1939.
It could also be added that the series really dates from the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was a global superpower. And for many people around the world, it was seen as an alternative model of economic development. E.H. Carr thought of the Soviet industrialization as one of the most important events of the 20th century. And that's why he wanted to begin to write its history. But he became old and felt that he was running out of documentary sources when he got to the end of the 1920s. But that's when Bob Davis took it up. Of course, times have changed since the Cold War, and the Soviet Union is no longer exists. But its significance is still very much debated. So, essentially, the series of which we've just completed the last volume describes the formative years of the Soviet superpower from the economic standpoint. Just to completely answer your questions, Steve, from his earliest days, has worked alongside Bob Davis, who is the originator of the series, of the present series. And although I was not Bob's student, I was a student at Oxford and Bob was at Birmingham, but I got to know Bob a little bit when I was already a graduate student. And in my whole career has... in which I spent at the University of Warwick, is close to Birmingham, and Birmingham has been one of the centres of study of these things, and I've always been there as a visitor, attended seminars, and occasionally worked with Bob, and it's been a privilege and an honour for me to join the team at this for this last volume.
Perhaps I could also add that E.H. Carr had always said that he didn't think it could ever go beyond 1929 because all of the literature did actually sort of dry up, the published literature. One of the big things, of course, that the project ran through was the opening up of the archives. And we do sort of pride ourselves very much on having a very archive-focused approach to this. This would not have been possible before sort of 1990s. So we're very fortunate that the archives did open up as we were working through this period.
One of the things I found very fascinating about the book was that the title of the seven volumes is The Industrialization of Soviet Russia. And both of you are coming at this from the standpoint of economics and economic history. And yet, one of the things you do in this volume, and I think this is one of the things that makes it such a fascinating volume to read, is how you integrate it with the broader context. This is not just economics or economic history alone or standing in a vacuum, but it's one in which you talk about it as this, if you will, the spine that defines so much of what's happening in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, in particular the period you're talking about here, which is from 1937 till 1939. That's so much of the Soviet Union, so much of in many respects, if I can draw upon the conclusion, the rest of the 20th century is shaped and defined by what's happening economically during this period.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted you picked that up, because I think so much of modern history of the Soviet Union is written without a good realization of the economic developments behind it. So I think it is extremely important, and I have a great sort of complaint about much of modern writing of Soviet history, that it doesn't adequately take into account this very important economic dimension, which was certainly put in full center here.
I think that's absolutely correct. And I know that our third and fourth co-authors, Alia Klyavnyuk, who's also been involved in this volume, and Bob himself would completely agree with that. I think it's inherent in the subject matter in a way that the leading principle of the Soviet economy was the politicization of economics. And so we are economists and economic historians, and our focus is on the economy, but we can't study that without also studying politics and policy. And so it's a compliment if you tell us that we've succeeded, but that was certainly our aim.
I wonder if you could perhaps, if the two of you could elaborate a bit upon what the Soviet economy was like in the mid-1930s when your volume begins. What was happening within the Soviet economy? What was the role of the state in it? And in what direction was the Soviet economy developing?
This is an economy that's very much dominated by the state. I mean, our volume starts in 1937, and it's also an economy that has recently recovered from a very grave crisis. So back in 1932, after the first wave of industrialization and the first five-year plan, the economy is in crisis. There's extensive shortages. There's a famine in which millions of people are literally starving to death. 5 years later, in 1937, there's been a recovery from that. So living standards have returned, probably not quite to the level of the 1920s, but at least the incidence of extreme hunger has greatly diminished. And for production, there's been a huge increase. So the economy of 1937 is probably getting on for twice the size of 1932. And in fact, if you look at the economic growth of the Soviet economy between the outbreak of World War One and the outbreak of World War Two, nearly all of the economic growth happens in those 5 years. So in 1937, it's kind of it almost looks like a high point. I think one of the interesting questions is whether the pace of recovery from the low point of 32 up to 1937 is sustainable. Possibly not. Possibly the economy was due for a slowdown anyway. But then, as Steve and I will probably mention in a minute, all sorts of complicating factors come into play in 1937 to cause a very abrupt slowdown.
Yeah, I'd like to add that although, of course, it's, you know, industrialization has been traveling at a tremendous rate, it is still a predominantly agricultural economy, and the agriculture is absolutely critical. And the one slight modification I'd just like to make is that although there's been these three extremely good years after the very bad 1932-33 harvest failure and famine, there was in 36 a drought, which did actually produce the first steadying effect. And I think, in fact, many, many of the consequences and the surprises were going to develop, partly because there had been a partial interruption and a steadying of the extraordinary growth that had taken place 33, 34, 35. Then, certainly with agriculture, from 36, there was a steadying and actually very severe fears that maybe they could be getting back into the famine again. So this is, I think, part of the uncertainty with which 36, well, the second half of 36, the first half of 37, the harvest year of the drought of 36 was characterized. And it is, I think, extremely important that this very sensitive period will go on until the next 37 harvest comes in, and that will then dramatically change the situation. But up until June, July 1937, there was still this very edginess brought about by this interruption of the recovery that had earlier set in.
There's actually one aspect of this that I think we probably need to explain a bit further before we go on, and that is an aspect of the economy which was practically unique in the Soviet Union at this time. You divide the economy into various sectors. You describe what's happening in industry, you describe what's happening in agriculture, you describe what's happening with defense. But there's this aspect of the economy of gulag. And the gulags are well known. Many authors have written about them. And they're thought about in terms of as prison camps dissidents and so forth were detained. But what you describe in the book is that they play this very important economic role that really it needs to be considered when you're looking at this, the development of the Soviet economy.
One of the most important aspects of the Gulag is that it was provided a ready labor force for government projects. And in some ways, I think of the economy as a whole as being driven by a couple of key decisions that were made frequently in the apex of the system, in the Politburo, which is the budget for capital construction and the defense budget. And these two budgets were often related because defense spending involved capital projects to build defense plants, to build railways, to provide materials to the economy. And when these decisions were made, the Gulag was often a convenient labor force to be thrown into the action in order to fill gaps, to make up shortages. And so as the 1930s wear on, the Gulag becomes more and more important in defense construction, in building the railways and the defense plants, the power systems that they thought would be important in time of war. But I have a sense that I probably interrupted Steve then, so I'm going to stop now.
No, I was just saying there's also, of course, a very important regional aspect to this, and that the Gulag was of particular importance in the particularly underdeveloped, distant regions, poorly populated, where there were lots of mineral resources which they wanted to get at. So in terms of the development of Siberia and the far north, you would not be able to get a free labor force there. The gulags were used in projects, particularly in those areas.
It's fascinating to think about it as a form of penal colonization, for forced colonization, bringing that into the functioning of the economy as a whole.
Well, the Bolsheviks definitely had this view, I think, that there are other people before them in Russian history, and there are other people after the Bolsheviks now who have the same view, which is you have all this territory, and in the interests of national power, the territory needs to be occupied and exploited. It leaves the nation vulnerable if you have a vast territory to the east of the Urals in which very few people live. It leaves it open to the greedy eyes of neighboring states who might want to take it for themselves. And so military colonization and penal colonization is an enduring theme in Russian history.
East of the Urals, of course, down in the south, particularly Kazakhstan, is also going to be important.
Now, when you open your volume in 1937, You have this event that is unfolding in the Soviet government and in Soviet life, and I'm referring to the purges, and as you describe it in the book, the purges loom really large in this volume and over the much of the period that you're writing about. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about how the purges affected the economy, how they affected the operations of the economy, and in what ways were other factors still as or more determinative in terms of economic impact?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the aspects which, before the archives opened up, we would be completely at a loss, because we really didn't know very much at all about the purges, apart from what was publicized. And what was publicized was really sort of high politics, the very leading figures. And they gave the impression that it was only the party leadership who were the main victims. We now talk about mass operations affecting large groups of people, and also a nomenklatura purge going through the whole ranks of party and state agencies, well, and military agencies, and not necessarily as closely tied to the narrow party political purges that have gone on before. They are related to them, but to some extent, this great nomenklatura purge and the mass operations will begin really from about the middle of 1937 and go onwards, and we'll have a totally different trajectory from the earlier well-known trials of the oppositions. And I think it's here particularly where we need to look at the new view from the archival source and just see how the party or the state agencies were so totally disoriented, leaderships of them being removed, more than purely the way the purges were affecting the former party leadership.
I think it's possible to make a sort of aggregate judgment, and this is what we try to make in the book, that the effects of the purges taken as a whole on the economy was generally negative, particularly in industry and construction and transport. It's clear that the stripping out of leading personnel led production to sag. Agriculture is a more complicated story, which perhaps we'll come to in a minute. But I think what we can't yet say exactly is what was the differential impact of the two streams that Steve has referred to. That is, there is a nomenklatura purge that affects tens of thousands of leading personnel, and there are the mass purges that were greater by an order of magnitude. Hundreds of thousands of people, up to a million and a half people, were arrested in the space of just over a year. And it's clear that, taken as a whole, this was enormously disruptive. But what we probably can't say right now is which of these two streams was the decisive impact.
One of the things I thought was interesting was how they fed upon each other. Was you would have these arrests and you would have this deprivation of experience in terms of management at various levels, and this would lead to disruptions, which would then be reflected in lower economic performance. Well, you can't blame the purges, and so therefore it must be saboteurs. So therefore it serves to justify yet further arrests, which exacerbate some of these economic drags upon development.
Well, although I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because in the first five-year plan, you have this revisions, you have this promotion into the new position of many people who were enthusiasts, but not particularly well-trained. What you had happening in certainly the first five-year plan from the late 20s right through the early 30s is a very large amount of training and new cadres coming in, often, in fact, which were much better trained than the people who had been put into leadership positions in the first five-year plan. So there are some areas in which, you know, you can actually see a new generation. Kosygin, some extent, was Nesensky, although Mark and I maybe have different views as to how beneficial it was, but a newly educated people who, in many cases, were better than some of the older groups that had been promoted during the really tumultuous time of the first 5-year plan, when the lack of sort of experience and specialists had been even greater.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I don't dissent at all.
There's another aspect of the purges that you also write about, which is how, and this is, it was an aspect that I hadn't really considered before, but how it, in some respects, hobbled certain things such as railway transportation, but also it had the effect of introducing large bodies of workers into the gulag sector. And so what you're seeing is not so much necessarily a deprivation of a million people necessarily, but you're seeing a shift from one role in the economy to now they're playing a role in a different aspect of the economy.
Yes, it's a blunt instrument for redistribution of the workforce. I mean, a blunt instrument in all the senses, including the worst senses of that term. And so hundreds of thousands of people who were previously engaged in normal sort of peaceful occupations suddenly found themselves led out into the wilderness to live in very poorly provided conditions, to cut down trees, to build railway lines and so on, or to mine for gold. It doesn't sound like an efficient process. It's a process that was enormously wasteful of the talents and skills that they had before, and also of their lives, because there was very high mortality in these camps in 1937. But yes, that redistribution also happened.
Yes, I mean, I think it was an extraordinary under-evaluation of the value of people. One of the things that seems to me to be happening is that part of, as a result of the mobilization for war and the increasing movement into military production, is things like, for instance, bulldozers and excavator production, of which had begun to rise, is now stopped, with production in that capacity moving over to tank production and effectively being substituted by labor, human power. It's almost as though, the value of the mechanized equipment which could be put to war seems to be far more valuable than that of the individual labor force.
You're referencing the military buildup as sort of the other shadow, if you will, that's being cast upon the economy during this period. I want to get to that in just a little bit, but I was wondering if the two of you could explain a bit more broadly what was happening in the Soviet economy during this period, during 1937, 1938, 1939, Was the economy growing? Were there elements of it that were stagnant? And what were some of the broader factors that were shaping and defining this development? Was it a matter of was it primarily being driven by planning? Were there environmental factors? How was the Soviet economy developing, broadly speaking?
Well, if I could start with agriculture and the environmental factors, I'd say it began with this drought affecting the harvest of 36, which will cast a shadow until the next harvest, which will only come in after July 37. So you do begin with this relatively bad factor hanging over agriculture. And it wasn't, as far as I can see, just that. It was the fact that I then had a very dangerous rundown of reserves, that in fact the 36-37 harvest situation would have been much more serious. It could easily have been a little bit more like the 32-33 famine had not the government really run down its reserves of food to a dangerous level. If that had been followed by a second harvest failure, then there would have been a disaster. As it turned out, the 37 harvest was quite extraordinary, and that was largely because of the weather. You can't give the Bolsheviks or organization much credit for this. The weather is really extraordinarily important. And the harvest was almost unbelievably high. When we have great doubts about many of the harvest figures, I was highly doubtful about the figures that were being reported. But we can see with food consumption, we can see through budget studies, suddenly, after the 37 harvest, there is large amounts of grain available, far more, in fact, than they had expected. So this gives all sorts of oddities to the agricultural sign. So agriculture really is going in, starts and staggering. Industry, Mark will talk to that. I think there was a more sort of continuous development and slowdown. But agriculture, you've got this extraordinary jerk right at the beginning of this period.
Industrial production and transport stagger under the blow of the repressions in 1937, and they recover somewhat in 1938 and 39. But in terms of the real action in the economy after 1937, it is in defense. And to a very considerable extent, this is a continuation of a process that goes back to the late 1920s. Soviet rearmament began then, but from a very, very small base. So the Bolsheviks did not inherit a very large defense industry from Imperial Russia and began to build it up from the 1920s. But because it was small, it took a long time to acquire scale. By 1937-38, defense industry is really motoring. And one of the things that we note at the end of the book is that by 1939, the Soviet Union was one of the great weapons producers in the world. This also imposes burdens on the economy, so because the defense industry is a tremendous user of fuels, of high-grade metals, non-ferrous metals, and skilled workers. So a huge amount of design and engineering skill goes into the build-up of the defense industry. And this is really the main structural change that is happening in the last years before the outbreak of World War II.
If I may clarify, to what degree was that planned going back to the early planning stages for that era? And to what degree was it a response to the events that were taking place?
I see it as a quite far-sighted and forward-looking process. If you go back to the 1920s, what the military are telling Stalin is that the character of war is changing, that the next war will be fought with huge numbers of tanks and planes, and that Russia is not ready. And there's a tradition of analysis of future war that begins to develop then. So this is not just a reactive process. They're not, you know, in the 1920s, they're not reacting to the threat from Japan, which hasn't yet materialized. You know, they start to worry about Japan in 1931. They're not remotely worrying about Hitler, who doesn't come to power until 1933. So this process starts before, you know, and the main fear of the 1920s is the threat of war from hostile neighbors such as Poland or the Baltic states, backed by Britain or France or by America. So it's at this point that they start to engage in a long-range process of rearmament. And indeed, part of this process is noting that the Soviet population in the 1920s is war-weary. They had 3 years of World War One, and then 3 or 4 more years of civil war. So 7 years of continuous fighting. Most people in the 1920s want peace, and the Bolsheviks understand that this is a problem that has to be managed. That the values of patriotism and military service and enthusiasm for these things had to be re-inculcated. And so, although, as I've said, the size of the Soviet military sector in the 1920s is quite small, there is quite a deliberate process of building it up, which begins then, works its way through the first, second, and third five-year plans, and culminates in this extraordinary situation by the time you get to 1939, that the Soviet Union is producing as many armaments as Germany. And that Germany in 1939 is working on Hitler's plan eventually to conquer the world. The Soviet Union doesn't have a plan of that nature, but nonetheless, it's up there with Germany in terms of the numbers of aircraft and armored vehicles and naval vessels and so on that are being built.
Yeah, if I could just add, of course, without the building of the metallurgical base in Magnitsky in the east of the Ural, in the first five-year plan, there would be no chance of building your tanks and your aircraft in the Second World War once the Ukraine has been occupied. So it's that first five-year plan development and building up of this new metallurgical base, which then allowed for the developments to take place later on. So this isn't just a response to things happening in the late 1930s. This is, as Mark said, a very long-sighted development.
Seems quite correct. And I mean, one of the things that the Bolsheviks understood, and Stalin and those around him, was that if you want to rearm, you have to build up industry in a broad, generalized way. You can't just have a narrow industrial base to support it. And indeed, the first five-year plans saw a very big shift in industrial activity towards the east. All through the 30s, they were balancing the problem, which was that they knew that the east was safe from attack from Western Europe. But they also knew that if you want to produce, you know, develop increases in production quickly, you do it where production already exists. So they had this tension between moving to the east or just building up industry where it was. In the mid-30s, the movement to the east slowed down a bit. When war broke out in 1941, they were caught with a lot of their important defense plants in the west, which they then had to evacuate out to the Urals and to Siberia. So, you know, the location of industry was a big strategic problem for them right through the 1930s. And, you know, they ended up with a compromise, which sort of worked in some ways in the way that Steve suggested. In other ways, they were still vulnerable when war broke out. But the build-up of engineering industry, metallurgy, railways, and so on, always had this defense angle.
I want to shift our focus now to a topic that wasn't really that was really unique to this period, and that was the issue of the census. And this came as it was a bit of a novelty to me to read about what happened with the census, because I found there were so many fascinating factors at work that run through your volume here in terms of the competing tensions of, on the one hand, the demands of the state, the concerns about the purge, and yet at the same time, you describe also these efforts by the demographers and the statisticians who are participating in this effort to try to do a professional job, and how oftentimes these two competing tensions, you know, often, you know, in some cases ran into each other. What was going on there? And what does that really tell us about the broader approach of the regime towards the realities of the economy?
Well, I think in many planning systems, there automatically almost develops a tendency to for the planners to want to be very ambitious, to plan for high figures, and then to exaggerate the growth that is taking place. I think you'll find that in Britain, planning wartime aircraft, it's almost an automatic feature that develops into. And so there had been massive distortion of all levels of production, particularly, I think, agriculture and population. Largely in the first five-year plan, which then continued through into the second five-year plan. And this was, you know, part of the way that the planning operation operated. Stalin then at one point started using population growth figures as an indicator of welfare. Life is getting better, comrades. Life is getting better. The population is growing at, one of his favorite statements was at sort of 3 million a year. A whole new Finland is being added to the Soviet Union every year. And so once Stalin has started saying that, it became very different. Difficult, and in fact, many statisticians, planners, and economists got into a lot of trouble by trying to bring the regime down to reality concerning that. And of course, a tragedy then developed. I think that in fact, we can, in historical terms, we can see two attempts at a sobering up of statistics in order to make the plans working better. One happened in 1932. Up until the statistical organization was merged into the state planning organization at the end of 1929. And then this led to what Yasny has correctly described as a sort of planning bacchanalia, where figures just go out completely crazy. Then, the beginning of 1932, Stalin did a very strange thing. He actually brought back the previous director of statistical services who had sacked for quarreling with him in 1928. And this was a very independent oppositionist figure, Osinsky, and he put him in charge of a revised statistical agency, although they didn't use the statistics, they called it National Accounting Agency, but it was basically to bring the statistics into a more realistic line. That, and I think if the famine hadn't developed in 1933, they would have possibly been able to get into correcting the distortions that had already happened within the population figures. But with the famine then taking place, and with a decision to try to deny the famine was taking place, then the distortions that had already appeared in the system were continued. And so when a census was carried out, the first one in 1937, they came up with a population figure which was 16 million, less than the figure that Gosplan had been planning for. The first five-year plan saw an expectation of population in 1937 of 178 million, and the census showed 162. There was a major discussion of this, and in the middle of the purges and the repression that was taking place, the decision was made to declare the census as wrecked, to execute the director of the statistical agency, many statisticians, and to call for a new census. Now, a second census was then carried out in 1939. There's a lot, I think, of misunderstandings about this, because in the West it's often described as though this was a false census as well, and that Stalin dictated the figures to this. But when the second census was carried out, they were second five-year plan was expecting a population figure of 183 million. And in fact, when the census did take place, it showed 167 million. It was still 16 million short. But the remarkable thing was that the statisticians, despite the large-scale killing of them, still came up with relatively realistic evaluations. And in fact, one of the heroic, I think, sort of earlier directors at Tsiu, Popov, actually wrote to Molotov and Stalin on the eve of the census, telling them, I'm an old statistician who was appreciated by Lenin, and I tell you that, in fact, when the census is carried out, the results will be the same, more or less, as previously, and that the problem isn't with the way the census is being carried out, but with Gosplan's expectations. This was accepted, and this was a major change between 37 and 39. There were still minor distortions concerning how they handled the, they call it the Spetskontingent, that's the number of the military and the number in the labor camps, but in fact, all censuses that were carried out in Europe on the eve of the Second World War did not reveal the true location of military forces. This was part of a kind of juggling that went on. With Russia, the juggling was actually greater, of course, because they included the large number, over a million in the labor camps in this juggling, and they also juggled them to try to fill in some of the gaps caused by the famine earlier. This has led many people, including Robert Konquistner, to talk about the 39 census as though it was a fake census. But we are arguing that it wasn't at all a fake census. It largely did correct the distortions that had previously been there in terms of the population, although there was and continued to be a degree of juggling as regards the Spetskontingent.
Well, you described how there's this very political edge to it, because when they're coming up with these numbers, it's not just a matter of they're going up against what the planners had done, but Stalin's made these very public statements, and if they publish figures that contradict that, well, then in effect they're challenging this image that Stalin has gone to great lengths to try to construct about himself.
Yeah, and they actually do that. And so, in fact, as I say, the Stalin's figures were compatible. I mean, the plans were made to be compatible with Stalin's figures. So they were expecting 183 million, and in fact, they only got 167. As a result, the figure was published, but it was published on two sheets of the side of Pravda and Izvestia, rather than the 28 volumes that the earlier census had come in, and there was a very difficult, embarrassing silence about what the scale of the census actually meant. Stalin didn't make any more references about population growing the size of Finland any longer, and people just kept quiet about that. It was a sobering up. And to some extent, I think it was important that there was so, because it did increase a degree of realism into the system. The problem was that in terms of agriculture, they were still dealing with production figures that were exaggerated by about 30%. And they continued to do so right through. This was not corrected at this time. And it was only after Stalin's death that they began including harvest losses in their calculation of grain production. There's a technical difference between biological yield, optimal yield at the time of harvesting, if it's harvested at the most optimal period, with absolutely no harvest or transportation losses, and then the way that it's normally measured, including about 20 or 30% of harvest loss. Now, this continued within the system. It's not arbitrary, because that actually does serve a purpose, because the peasants are made responsible for the harvest losses. So by, if you like, billing them with the full biological yield, at the time of harvest, any of the losses that take place are slated to the peasant. So this is a way of basically putting an incentive on the peasants to work harder, an impossible incentive, but it is a way of sort of screwing the peasants more, which is productive in terms of the way the system was working, but totally false, exaggerated population figures weren't going to help at all during the war effort. So elements of distortion continued. Some of them were removed, and the political embarrassment of correcting wrong views of certain politicians were glossed over, which happens in some other societies as well.
You mentioned the war effort, Stephen, and that gets to what is increasingly looming large as you get further into the book, which is the onset of war. And of course, the thought is the Russo-German war. But you are talking in the book as well about how at the start of the book, the Soviet Union already has a very large military assistance program to the Republican government in Spain. They're helping out the various sides in China, and how this is part of what's contributing to the state. Is there any shift that takes place as war looms in Europe generally? I mean, do they simply continue with the programs and the war happens, or is there a growing acceleration of their of the defense preparations as events in Europe deteriorate more generally?
Over to Mark.
Okay, so I think something to understand here is that in the 20th century, it was industrial rearmament took time. It was hard and costly to sort of switch it on and off. When war broke out, and you look at the economies of Britain, the Soviet Union, America, you do see very, very sharp increases in war production. But these are bought with just colossal effort, absolutely colossal effort. And even then, it would take a year or two to ramp up war production to the war, anywhere near their wartime peaks. So very, very sort of short-term adjustments in war production to the evolution of events are very hard to pick out, to identify. When you look at the general pattern of the growth of Soviet defense industry, it's pretty continuous. But it's pretty continuous partly because it's the nature of the process that it just relies a lot on momentum. To build up, to suddenly increase aircraft production, you have to have more aluminium, more workers, more factories. You can't just snap your fingers and create them overnight. So what this creates is a process which more or less inevitably is very hard to tie to immediate events. It's quite hard to measure war production in the aggregate. Part of the problem is that the changes of quality and quantity are very interrelated. So it's very hard to say that even in 1938 that war production was an exact percentage of war production in 1937, because by 1938 the entire complement of aircraft may be different from that of 1937. But nonetheless, one of the things that we do is we look at things like the development of the number of defense research establishments. And essentially, they sort of double every few years, starting from 1917 up to 1939. But what you do see is the interval over which they double gets gradually shorter. So it takes 7 or 8 years for the first doubling, 5 or 6 years for the next doubling, 3 or 4 years for doubling after that, and so on. So having spent years of trying to understand the process and the data, I've sort of given up on the game of trying to say, well, you know, this increase in war production is attributable to that decision or that that external event. It's best just to think of this 20th century war production as a very sort of long-range inertial process. There is acceleration, but it's very hard to attribute to any particular decisions or events.
Yeah.
May I just add to that? That's important from a political economy perspective, which is that when there is a sudden crisis of external relations, Stalin can't just magic up another million troops or another 1,000 aircraft. And what he often seems to do instead is to think, okay, we have an external crisis which makes us weaker. When we're weaker, what's the most dangerous thing to me? That is the awakening of the internal enemy. So side by side with this rearmament process, Stalin is continually receiving reports from the towns, from the countryside, what is the state of public opinion? When there's some disturbing external event, the NKVD, the secret police at the time, brings back to him reports of the public mood. And the public mood is often, oh, are the Japanese going to invade? Will there be a war? If there's a war, they're going to give out guns. I'll have a gun. Who will I shoot? And Stalin's an old revolutionary. He lived through the crisis of 1917 when the workers and the soldiers had guns and had to decide who they were going to shoot. And he's very frightened of what external disturbance can do to internal security. And this is one of the things that more clearly drives the repression than changes in defense spending or defense production. Sorry, that was a complicated thought. I don't know if I made sense.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that in terms of agriculture, it's actually very strange because you could think with war coming, what you ought to do is get agriculture ready for it. What had happened in war was that more people were eating potatoes. The private plot production would become more important. But curiously, it's exactly at this time that the government policy moves in the opposite direction. There is a tightening up on control over private plots and the amount of land that the peasants could, Kolkhoz peasants could farm for themselves, specifically at the time when this would begin to be, you'd think, or to becoming more important. As it happens during the war, of course, they have to let go on this, and there will be an enormous expansion of the private sector. But in the years just before the war takes place, the economic policy is actually moving in the opposite direction. And that indicates to me that, certainly as regards, Stalin isn't looking abroad saying, how should I change policy as a result of this? Certainly wanting to continue with a traditional policy and more concerned, I think, as Mark was saying, with the sort of political aspects of this rather than how this will work out economically.
I think that's right. And you can see that, for example, in the purging of the military, 1937-38, the purging of the military specialists, the weapons specialists. But by 1938, a lot of them are being put to work in the Gulag, in specialist research institutions that are behind barbed wire. And you wonder how productive that all was for the economy or for military security. And I think the answer is that for Stalin, at certain points, internal security became the most important thing. It's a dangerous world out there. We may be attacked at any time. How can I secure my rear? And again, you go back to the revolutionary and civil war years. Stalin was one of the people sent out into the provinces to secure the rear on the fronts of the civil war. And one of the things that he was continually aware of and continually spoke of was the need to have a solid rear in the event of an international conflict. And controlling the rear, controlling the forces that might be hostile to the regime in the rear, the enemy that could stab you in the back, was at certain points more important to him than being the obvious things that would promote external security.
Now, what the two of you described is very much a economy that's a product of this very distinct figure, Joseph Stalin, and of these of developments that surround this extraordinary series of events dating back to 1917, 1914, and so forth. And yet, as you conclude that, and here I'm reading directly from your final chapter, the economic system that Stalin built in the 1930s persisted with remarkable continuity to the end of the Soviet Union. How was it able to endure for as long as it did, absent these factors of transformation that created it in the first place?
Well, I think part of the answer is that this is a partial answer. There are two parts of the answer. One is that it kind of worked. I mean, by the outbreak of World War II, the Soviet economy did have a big army, a big defense industry, was able to fight and eventually to win that war despite, you know, horrendous losses, despite the deep invasion. And then the other thing is that, you know, probably it's just to bear in mind those words precisely, the economic system endured. The political system became considerably moderated after Stalin's death, and in fact had begun to moderate itself before he died, probably. And the people around Stalin understood that his system of rule was in many ways enormously wasteful. If you think of you know, what to do about the potential opposition at home, Stalin's recipe was all too often, if you suspect someone of disloyalty, you shoot them. You know, he, at certain times, he seems to have had on at least one occasion articulated a sort of 5% rule. If there's a 5% chance that somebody's a spy, you need to get rid of them. And this is one of the things that lay behind the huge losses of the Great Terror and the wasteful character of the Gulag in terms of its use of human raw material. And so the people who took power after Stalin, you know, wanted to rule in a more humane way. They didn't want to shoot everybody. They didn't want to arrest everybody. They wanted to control society. They wanted to run the Soviet Union as a great power, the global superpower, but they clearly wanted to do it more efficiently. And so this is also part of the story. I mean, we don't go into that in the book, but it's you know, having said that, I'll wait with interest to see if Steve is going to agree with me, but with what I've just said. But I think so there are strong continuities from Stalin through Khrushchev and Brezhnev, but there are also quite important changes. Khrushchev unusually had a conscience. He didn't like killing people. He wanted to rule in a different way. He himself was probably could be classed as a mass murderer, but he was uncomfortable about it. And all credit to him for that.
I'm less sympathetic to Khrushchev, but I certainly do agree that there were enormous changes after Stalin's death, and particularly within agriculture. So I mentioned that there'd been this really false position of lying about the level of grain production to the extent that you were automatically forcing the peasants into an impossible position. Well, that could not change, could not continue, and will change very quickly after Stalin's death. So there's biological yield distortion. Lying about the level of grain production is already out by 1954. And so you're seeing a whole series of changes in which certainly the position of the peasant is nothing like as terrible as it had been, and prices begin to increase for them. And after this, of course, the collective farm remains until the end of the Soviet period, but it's changed enormously, and the living standards of the amount of pressure that was placed on the peasants has changed enormously after the war. But yeah, I politically, of course, there are these enormous changes, and there were groups that were trying to find more ways of changing. it's often argued, I mean, this is getting way beyond what he's talking in the book, but to some extent, you know, finding oil and a way of propping up the economy without necessarily having to take the reform that perhaps should have been taken 30 years earlier, may have been a bit of a sort of disaster for the Soviet Union. I don't believe that there was not necessarily a way that it could have been reformed. What we do know was that the economy was not reformed, and so it all collapsed in 1991.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what the two of you are working on next?
Yeah, well, I'm actually having spent an awful lot of time working in the 20s and 30s. Well, I'm pre-revolutionary period. I am now working on the post-Second World War period. I'm particularly interested in the world food crisis of 1946-47. Both in the Soviet Union, where our knowledge about what was going on had earlier been so short, but also in comparison with other countries. So I'm looking at the world food crisis of 46-47 in its international aspects, but bearing in mind that it was most serious and we knew least about it in the Soviet Union.
So for VoxEU, which is the website of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, I'm currently working on an ebook with my colleague Stephen Broadbury on the economics of World War I, the economics of the Great War. There'll be a chapter on Russia, I think, by Andrei Markevich, who's one of my co-authors currently in Moscow. That's in the very short term because it's got to be done by November, the centenary of the end of the war. Beyond that, a few years ago, I discovered a wonderful archive, which is the archive of the Lithuania KGB. It's on paper in Vilnius, and it's on microfilm at the Hoover Institution in California. Ever since I discovered that, I've been as happy as a boy in a sandbox. And I have two little projects arising out of that. One is on informers, and the other is on political surveillance and low-level political policing. There's such a lot of fun in that because there's so many great stories. They're horrifying stories sometimes. Sometimes they're a bit grim, but a lot of them, you know.
Not a lot of fun. Something to laugh.
The principle of the Soviet joke was you have to find something to laugh at. And there's a lot of little stray amusing insights into human behavior that you can get out of this stuff. So I'm enjoying myself with it.
Well, those all sound like fascinating projects, although I have to say I totally appreciate why you are concluding the industrialization of the Soviet Union falling where it is. I am sorry that you know it is ending here and not continuing into the future, because it sounds like there's so much more to tell, although you will be telling aspects of it in these other projects. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedules to speak with us. I hope you both have a wonderful day.
Thank you.